thinks that the what it is to specify a scientific theory is to specify exactly what kinds of statistics of outcomes of measurements you might get. So for an operationalist, it's important to know what the full set of possible statistics are. So you want to know what's the most general experiment, what are the most general preparations and the most general measurements, and the full range of statistics that you could achieve in an experiment. And as we saw last time, a vector in Hilbert space is not the most general representation of a preparation. You can also have density operators. So let me just review very quickly that. So we saw that if you have a mixture of vectors in Hilbert space, so you've implemented one preparation, but you don't know which one. So maybe a dice has been rolled, and one of these was implemented with a certain probability distribution, but you only know what that probability distribution is and not which one was implemented. In that case, this object here, the operator, which is the weighted sum of the projectors onto these vectors, gives you a complete specification of what statistics you would get for measurements following that preparation. The other case was when you have a preparation of a pair of systems in some pure state, a vector over the Hilbert space of S tensor the Hilbert space of A, and you only look at one of those two systems. In that case as well, the object you should use now to describe the box that outputs this system alone is an operator, which can be obtained from this vector here by taking the partial trace over the system that doesn't emerge from the box. So I wanted to say a little bit more about that. That's where we ended last time. I showed you that the mixture of pure states, the mixture of vectors, gave you an operator that was positive. So it had positive expectation for all vectors. And it had unit trace. And so the same is true for this reduced density operator. That's what they call the ones that are obtained by partial trace on a bipartite state. So the proof is not hard. If I take a state in the Hilbert space of the system S, and I take any state, and I take the expectation value of rho S, I acted on this. Well, this expectation value can move through the trace because there are operations on different Hilbert spaces. So it's just the trace over A of this object. But each of these things is one of these partial inner products. It's a vector on SA, inner product with a vector on S, and that just gives me some vector on A. So the thing on the inside is just the projector onto some vector in A, defined as follows. And one of the properties of the trace that we saw last time is that the trace of an outer product just gives me the inner product. And so this is a norm, and it's necessarily positive. So you know that for any vector here, the expectation value of rho will be positive. And that's the definition of what it is to be a positive operator. I should mention, I haven't written it up here, but another way of thinking about positivity of operators is that an operator is positive if it's Hermitian, and therefore you can diagonalize it, and all of its eigenvalues are positive. So that's also holds for the reduced density operator. The second property is also trivial to check. If you take the trace over the Hilbert space for system S of rho S, then you're tracing over S followed by a trace over A. That's equivalent to tracing over the whole Hilbert space of S and A. And because this state here was a normalized vector on the whole Hilbert space, when I take this trace, I just get the inner product of the state with itself, and that's one. So this also has unit trace. Okay, so here's an example of a reduced density operator. You may have seen this in Ben's course, so this is probably a review. So if I have some complex coefficients A and B, and this pair of states, 0 tensor 0 and 1 tensor 1, then the first thing I do is I take the outer product of this bipartite state with itself. And so I get four terms. I get the diagonal terms here, and then the two cross terms. So 0, 1, tensor 0, 1, and 1, 0, tensor 1, 0. And now if I trace over A, I'm just tracing over this piece here. And each one of these outer products becomes an inner product. So this is, 0 inner product with 0 after I take the trace. And that's just 1. So I just am left with this term. Similarly here, I'm left with this term. But for each of these terms, when I turn that outer product into an inner product, because 1 and 0 are orthogonal, I get 0, and so these terms disappear. So the partial trace is just the mixture of 0 and 1 on the first system. Good. So far, I've defined density operators in terms of ways in which they can arise by mixtures and by reductions. But you can also characterize them intrinsically, just in terms of their properties. So any operator that's positive and has trace 1 is a density operator. And you can ask, is it the case that for all such operators, there's some way of preparing them in the lab? There's something I could do such that the statistics I get afterwards are characterized by that operator? It turns out the answer is yes. In fact, there's both an ensemble. So an ensemble is a set of normalized vectors, psi I, and a probability distribution over I. There is an ensemble that has rho as its density operator. And furthermore, there's some pure state on a pair of copies of the system you're interested in. So if your system has a particular Hilbert space, take two copies of that Hilbert space. There exists some state on that pair of Hilbert spaces whose reduced density operator is the operator you're interested in. The proof is not hard to see. It makes use of the spectral resolution of rho. So if I write down a diagonal decomposition of any operator that's positive and has trace 1, I can write in this form where the k's form an orthonormal basis. So here, these lambda k's could be degenerate. They could have the same value for different values of k. And in that case, just as an aside, there are many, if there's some degeneracies here, then there are many choices of bases for which this decomposition is possible. And just imagine one of them. So if that's the case, then assuming positivity of rho implies that for all psi, this is positive. So in particular, if I take one of these k vectors, it will be positive for it. But if I take a particular k and I take the expectation value, well, it's going to eliminate all the terms except the kth one, because these are an orthonormal basis. And so I'll just be left with lambda k for that value of k, and it will be positive. So that shows that these lambda k's can be considered as probabilities. They're positive. So all you need to show now is that they sum to 1, and you'll know that this set of states, together with these weights, form an ensemble. And so to see that these sum to 1, you just make use of the fact that you know that trace of rho is 1. And if you take the trace of this expression, well, each one of these outer products of k with itself becomes an inner product, and that's just 1. So it just gives me sum over k lambda k equal to 1. So these lambdas are a probability distribution, and this says that if I weight the k's with those probabilities, I get rho. So questions about that? Yes?
So the expression of rho that we started with, we're stating that given that rho is a positive operator, we basically first diagonalize it.
Yes.
And that's when we can write it like that.
That's right. Because you know it's positive, you also know it's Hermitian, right, and therefore diagonalizable.
Right, and that's where we start. And
that's right. That's right. And then you use positivity again to prove that these lambdas are not just real eigenvalues, but positive eigenvalues. In fact, I mean, you could have gone straight from there. You could say, well, because I know it's a positive operator, I know its eigenvalues are real, and the lambda k are its eigenvalues, so they must be, sorry, I know that its eigenvalues are positive, therefore, I know the lambda k's must be positive. Okay, so now the second half was, for every operator that's positive and has unit trace, you can find some bipartite state that... Oh, sorry, I missed that. Yes?
This holds for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces,
too? There is a subtlety regarding infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Let me see if I can remember what it is. There is something that... I'm not sure if this holds for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Let me get back to you on that.
You need to demand regularity?
Yeah,
so I mean, like,
Because you can get things like the Dirac deltas.
Yeah.
This, if I recall correctly, in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, there are states that they refer to as intrinsically mixed, meaning that you can't find a decomposition into pure states. So a question you can ask, given this is the Foundations course, I think this is an interesting question. It comes up at Foundations conferences pretty often. If you find some mathematical fact about infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, does it have physical significance? Because you can always argue that any experiment I do in the lab, so let's put on our operationalist hat and say, look, any experiment I do in the lab, I might require a very high dimensional Hilbert space to explain those statistics. It seems like I shouldn't need an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Because every experiment has finite precision. I can only distinguish so many outcomes. So why should I ever need an infinite dimensional Hilbert space to describe it? And if so, anything mathematically that changes for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, you could argue, will have no significance for any experimental statistics. It might be relevant because using an infinite dimensional Hilbert space is often more convenient than using a large finite dimensional Hilbert space. And therefore, if you run into mathematical difficulties, that might be an obstacle to solving the problem you want to solve. But that's very different from saying that this particular mathematical feature would have some significance in the lab, that there would be some phenomena associated with it. Other questions? Okay, so this always works better when I can sort of give you one equation at a time and step through it. So try to ignore all of this. The question is, can we find a bipartite state that has an arbitrary rho as its reduced density operator? So again, we use this diagonal decomposition of rho. And this, we construct this state here. And it looks like all my tensor products have disappeared. But everywhere you see a gap here, there ought to be a tensor product. So I just take the vectors that appear in this decomposition. And I use the same vector. So I take a second copy of the system, which I'll call little a. And I have a basis defined for that system as well. And I just take k tensor k. I sum them up coherently. And for the amplitudes, I use the square roots of these weights here. So then if I take the outer product of this state with itself, that's just the state times its adjoint. And if I write that out, I can write that as a double sum over k and k prime of these amplitudes and these off-diagonal terms tensor these guys. And now I want to trace over A and see what the reduced density operator on system S is. And so again, I trace over this bit alone. That gives me an inner product between k prime and k, but it's an orthonormal basis. So that's just a delta, a Kronecker delta. So it just picks out the diagonal pieces of this guy. So I'm left with this. And that is the density operator I started with. OK, so the slogan for this is that people call these states purifications of rho. So it's a state. It's a pure state. Pure means it's associated with a vector. And it has rho as its reduction. And what this means, this actually is significant for interpretational issues, because if you want, you can do without density operators. By moving to a larger Hilbert space, you can always represent things by vectors. So even though I might have, for example, a mixture of preparation procedures, if I take the dice that are used to prepare that mixture and treat them quantum mechanically, then the dice together with the system can be in a pure state. And this result is a way of capturing that fact. So the point is that for any operator that satisfies these conditions, you can find mixtures that lead to it, and you can find purifications of it. And in fact, you can find many of each. I've shown you the existence. But in fact, there's a multiplicity of ensembles that lead to the same density operator and many purifications of a given density operator. And I think you probably saw this in the tutorial yesterday, so this should be familiar. Here are just two examples. If I take a state on a two-dimensional Hilbert space, which is just identity over two. So in the block sphere, which you heard about in Ben's course and in the tutorial as well, that's the point at the center. Then it can be decomposed into any basis. So in particular, the 0-1 orthonormal basis will decompose it, but so will the plus-minus basis, where plus is defined as 0 plus 1 over root 2, and similarly for minus. So the significance of this is that there's very different experiments, right? So you can do a mixture of these two preparations, or a mixture of these two preparations, and I put each one of those in a black box, and I pass the two black boxes to you, and I say, please distinguish whether you have a mixture of 0 and 1, or whether you have a mixture of plus and minus. You can do any experiment you like. Every measurement you can conceive of, you measure the statistics. And because their overall density operators are the same, the statistics will be exactly the same for all measurements. So there's no way you can solve that problem and tell me what's inside the black box. So that's, for an operationalist, that's the kind of statement that distinguishes quantum theory from other theories, that there are certain mixtures of preparations that are indistinguishable from other mixtures of preparations. For an operationalist, that's the kind of statement that really tells you what quantum theory is. That's the at the core of what quantum theory is. And similarly, you can find many different entangled states which all have the completely mixed state as the reduction for the first system, the reduced density operator for the first system. Yes?
Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if you mentioned the notation here, the last two, you mean that the density, trace of the density operator made from that pure state, right?
Yes, that's right. I'm sorry. I should have really written this tensor, the adjoint of this. So that's actually a mistake. You can't take the trace of a vector. You have to take the trace of a density operator. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for pointing that out. Okay, so one aside that I wanted to get back to from the first lecture was the difference between a state like this, a coherent superposition of 0 and 1, and a state like this, which is called an incoherent mixture of 0 and 1. So B can have it's a complex number, it can have a phase, but these are real numbers, they have no phases. So the difference is if I look at this as a density operator, so I take the projector onto that state, it has these off-diagonal terms. And that's where the phase of B lies. And if I just do measurements of the 0-1 basis, all I get are statistics, probability A squared, the first outcome, probability B squared, the second outcome, and it's exactly the same as what I get here. But as soon as I start doing measurements of other bases, the fact that it's a coherent superposition is relevant, and I'll get different statistics for this state than I do for this state. So if I measure the plus-minus basis, this will give me different results from this one. And so that fact, so now that we have seen density operators, that's what I was talking about in the first lecture when I said that any attempt to just interpret this state as either, so remember this is the state that occurs when you treat the apparatus quantum mechanically in the Stern-Gerlach experiment. So it's some coherent superposition of Z spin up, apparatus indicates up, Z spin down, apparatus indicates down. To interpret that as either this or this with those probabilities would be to interpret it as the incoherent mixture of these guys. And they're different states. And so there's measurements you can do on this one. So measurements of a coherent superposition of these two things, which will distinguish this state from the mixture described here. And so that's the sense in which you have to interpret this somehow differently. So far, so good? So I'm going to move on to measurements. Are there any remaining questions about the most general kind of preparation procedure? Clear? Okay. We're going to come back to it in later in the course when we talk about the Cauchy-Specker theorem and contextuality. It's related to Bell's theorem. And this, so this multiplicity of different decompositions of a mixed state into pure states shows up there. And it also shows up in axiomatizations, attempts to derive the quantum formalism. So we'll see that again. So the next question is, what's the most general kind of measurement? Thus far, we've been talking about measurements associated with Hermitian operators. So I'm allowing this to be a density operator now, but the measurements are associated with Hermitian operators, and if I decompose that Hermitian operator spectrally, and I pull out the projectors in the spectral resolution, then the probability rule is just trace of rho, the density operator, times those projectors. So the question is, what sorts of measurements won't be amenable to such a representation? I just mean it won't have such a representation. So suppose I'm looking for a measurement procedure such that the rule for calculating the probability of the outcomes of that measurement cannot be given in this form, trace of rho times some projector. Yes?
If you throw off some of your results, or if you do your measurements, right, probabilistically, choose one
measurement probabilistically from a set of possible measurements. Yes, that's right. That won't be able to be modeled in this way. And I think that's actually my first example. So let me move on to that example. I'm just going to make one comment before doing that, which is that for quantum information theorists, it makes more sense to associate a measurement not with a Hermitian operator, but with the set of projectors that appear in its spectral resolution. Because as we talked about last time, if I have two Hermitian operators that have different eigenvalues but the same projectors in the spectral resolution, they correspond to the same measurement procedure because the probabilities of the different outcomes are exactly the same. All the eigenvalues do is give you a convention for how you're going to label those outcomes. And so if you're really interested in the statistics of the experiment, then you don't care so much about how you're labeling the outcomes. And what you're really interested in is that probability distribution. And in fact, taking expectation values is throwing away information. You know, if you have a nice probability distribution and you just take the expectation value, then you know you've lost the information about what the variance is and all the higher order moments. So if you really want to characterize the measurement, you should characterize the whole distribution. And the object that allows you to do that is the set of projectors appearing in your Hermitian operator. So sometimes people talk about projection-valued measures, which just means a set of projectors that sum to identity. And you can represent measurements, certain kinds of measurements, in that way. Let me skip this and move forward to that first example. So I'll tell you the result. The result is going to be that we have to model measurements by positive operator-valued measures, so sets of positive operators that sum to identity. So here's the example. Suppose that you have a box now, a black box, and in it a dice is rolled and a decision is made between which of a set of possible measurements is going to be implemented. So the idea is that some system gets passed in here and then it gets fed into one of these boxes depending on how the dice roll came down. And then whatever the outcome of that measurement is, it gets fed out as the outcome of that black box. So I'm imagining that each of these measurements has the same set of outcomes. Okay, so now you can ask, well, what are the statistics for the overall box? Can we calculate what the probability of getting outcome K is if I have a preparation over here in associated with density operator rho? So the calculation is straightforward. You just say, well, the probability of getting outcome K is going to be the probability of getting outcome K given that I measured measurement number I, right? So I've labeled the measurements 1, 2, 3 here. So if I were just doing one of these, I would know what the probabilities of outcome k would be. And so I know that these p of k given I is just trace of the projector p pi sub k for the ith measurement. Okay? Trace of that times rho. This is the probability of getting outcome k in just one of these guys. And then I weight that probability with the probability that the ith measurement was actually done. And I sum over I. And so that will tell me the total probability of getting the kth outcome. So, you know, the probability of getting outcome number one is the probability that I got outcome number one by virtue of it having occurred in the first measurement, the probability of getting outcome one by virtue of it having getting the outcome one in the second measurement, and so on. So this is just classical probability theory using the quantum formula here. And then I just rearrange. I can move the sum over I inside the trace and the pi inside the trace because it's a scalar. And I organize things this way. And so this single mathematical object characterizes what's inside this box. So if I take trace of rho times ek, so ek is the name I'm giving to this thing, then I'll get the probability for seeing the kth outcome. So rather than having a projector, I now have a weighted sum of projectors representing my measurement procedure. And if you ask what properties does that have, well, what you find is that they're positive, and they sum to identity. So what's the proof of that? So the definition of a given EK is just this weighted sum here. If I plug that in to an expectation value for some arbitrary state psi, then I pull that expectation through to the pi's, and each of these expectations is a positive number, because this would be the probability of getting outcome k if I just did this measurement here. And so it's a sum of positive numbers, it's positive. Similarly, if I sum over k, then I can pull that sum over k through the sum over I, and I'm just summing up the projectors now over k. But these guys, the pi k's, form a projection-valued measure. They were a set of projectors that summed to identity. They came from the spectral resolution of a Hermitian operator, and the projectors that appear in such a spectral resolution have to span the whole Hilbert space. So when I sum up those projectors, I should get the identity operator. So this is just sum over I pi times identity, so it's just identity. Hopefully this is review for you, because I think Ben covered POVMs. Did he, Tuber?
Yeah.
He did. Okay. Yes? Yes?
The explicit expression for the POVM you wrote in terms of the projector, is that the most general expression for POVM?
It's not. So you could ask the same question here. If you give me a set of operators, some EKs, all of which, every element of which is positive, and they sum to identity, does it follow that I could find a set of projective measurements which I could mix in some way to give me that POVM? And the answer in that case is no. So it's unlike the situation with density operators, where you were always able to find a mixture. Turns out that there are POVMs that can't be measured in this way. So there's another approach to measuring POVMs, which I'll talk about now. Well, no, actually, I was going to go through an example first, it seems. So let me do the example, and then I'll talk about the other approach to measuring POVMs. So here, it's just a very simple mixture. Suppose I have a measurement of the 0-1 basis and a measurement of the plus-minus basis. And I choose which of them to do with just a uniform probability distribution, a half. And then I just record whether I got the first outcome or the second outcome. So really what I'm doing is I'm mixing this projector with this projector. So the first element of the POVM is just a half 0 plus a half plus. And the second element of the POVM is a half 1 plus a half minus. And now note that these things, if I sum up this guy with this guy, I will get identity, because if I took a quarter, a quarter, a quarter, a quarter, which is a probability distribution, and I weighted these four states, I would get the completely mixed state, the one that sits at the center of the Bloch sphere, just by symmetry. And so if I take a halves here, then I just multiply the right-hand side by 2, and I have identity. Another way of seeing that is by actually drawing these things in a Bloch sphere picture. So just for review purposes, the Bloch sphere is a way of representing all the density operators for a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And the surface of the Bloch sphere, let's see if I can draw this. The surface of the Bloch sphere corresponds to the pure states, and inside the Bloch sphere corresponds to the mixed states, and the center corresponds to identity over 2. So the state at the north pole is 0, the state at the south pole is 1. This would be plus and minus here. And at the other, I'll call these plus I and minus I, and they correspond to 0 plus I1 and 0 minus I1. The way you get this representation is basically by thinking of your density operator as a vector in a four-dimensional vector space of Hermitian operators, and then decomposing it, finding its coefficients with respect to the poly basis, the poly operators. Poly operators are identity, sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. So if I represent rho in terms of those guys, it turns out I can always write it as 1 half identity plus 1 half the vector of poly operators dotted with some vector r. And that vector r is a representation of the density operator rho. So that's the Bloch sphere. It's conventionally used to help you with your intuitions about density operators for qubits. I'm going to use it here to help you think about these measurements. So each of these operators that appears in a POVM is positive. And so if it had trace 1, if I normalized it to have trace 1, it would be a density operator. And so I can point out where in the Bloch sphere that density operator would lie. And it's helpful for thinking about what these POVM elements mean. So this POVM here, if I think about these four states, 0, 1, plus and minus, and I look at just a plane of the Bloch sphere, so the ZX plane, there are the four points here, north, south, east, west. And now if I mix this guy and this guy with equal weights, as you saw in the tutorial, you get the point that's equally between these two ends. And if you mix these guys here, you get this point. So these two operators correspond to these two points in the Bloch sphere. So you can think of this measurement as close to the measurement which would correspond to these two points. So antipodal points in the Bloch sphere, points that are on opposite poles, correspond to orthogonal states. And so these two points correspond to an orthogonal basis, and that's a projective measurement. The fact that I'm pulling these points in from the surface is like saying I'm doing a noisy version of that measurement. Let me explain that in more detail, why I should think of this. So the interpretation of this guy now is going to be a noisy measurement corresponding to the basis defined by this ray in the Bloch sphere. So here's why you could think of it that way. Here's a different setup. So again, I'm going to do a mixture of two measurements. So the 0-1 measurement is going to be one of them. And the other one is going to be a trivial kind of measurement. So this measurement says, throw out the system. Don't even bother looking at it, and just flip a fair coin. So from an operationalist perspective, that's a procedure. I can, it's a recipe for what to do, and it has an outcome. The outcome is the outcome of the coin flip. So it's a perfectly valid measurement. It may not fit our intuitive notion of what a measurement is, because it reveals nothing about the system. It has no information about the system. But it's technically a measurement nonetheless. And the way it's represented is by a pair of elements. So this element represents the first outcome, this element represents the second outcome, and it's just one half identity. And the reason for that is if I put an arbitrary state rho and I ask what's the probability of getting the first outcome in that measurement, well, this is just, I can pull the half out, trace of rho, but trace of rho, because rho is a density operator, is always 1, so that's a half. So what this tells me is that no matter what preparation I do prior to this measurement here, I always get the first outcome with probability half. And that's right, because what I'm doing is ignoring the system and flipping a coin. So that's exactly what I want. So this funny POVM, a half identity, just describes a coin flip. So what I'm doing here is I'm taking a different kind of dice, which is weighted q and 1 minus q, so some arbitrary probability, and either feeding the system into this measurement of 0, 1, or just flipping a coin. And so if q is quite high, then maybe there's low probability of this. And you can think of this as, you know, sometimes your measurement just fails, and the outcome has nothing to do with the system you fed in. The outcome is just random. So you can think of this as a way of thinking about a noisy measurement. Sometimes it gives you just a random outcome. So given how, you know, the way we figured out how to mix POVMs, I just need to take probability q times 0 plus probability 1 minus q times a half identity. And that's the operator I associate with getting the first outcome of this overall effective measurement. And the second operator is the one I associate with getting the second outcome. And if I draw these on the block sphere, well, you know, you can think of it either as a mixture of the central point, that's identity over 2, and the north pole, which is the projector onto 0. So q will tell me where I am along this line. Or if you want to, you can rewrite identity as a mixture of 0 and 1 and think of this as just, you know, a mixture of these two points. It doesn't really matter how you think about it. You end up with some point here. And similarly for the second outcome, you get some point down here. And so this picture here is a depiction of a noisy measurement of the 0, 1 basis. If it had no noise, then these points would move out to the surface. And I would just, my measurement outcomes would correspond to the projector onto 0 and the projector onto 1. And the more noise I add, the closer it gets to the center. And when I get right to the center, I just have a half identity, a half identity. And then it's just a coin flip. And I have no information about the system at all. So these POVMs allow you to describe noisy measurements. And because every measurement we do in the lab has some noise, in effect, you know, the projection-valued measures, the ones that are associated with Hermitian operators, the ones we learn about in undergrad, are an idealization which actually never really holds. And this is the more realistic description of what's actually going on in the lab. Yes?
So, in the previous example, we had we were choosing between two measurements.
Yes.
One was a 0, 1, and one was a plus minus.
Yes.
But suppose we didn't. So plus minus is 90 degrees on the block sphere. It's 90 degrees.
It's this pair of states.
I could have the second one. I could have chosen instead of plus minus some other pair of antipodal points.
Right.
And then I could have kind of gone something similar to the one you were describing, or.
Yeah. So. So here. You know, we at the end of the day, we get a measurement that's a noisy version of the measurement that would have corresponded to these two points. But suppose I want to get my noisy version of the 0, 1 basis, then, you know, I could, for example, choose, say, this pair of antipodal points and this pair of antipodal points.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I coarse grain these two outcomes here and these two outcomes, and then I get my noisy version of the 0, 1 measurement.
But there's a limit to the noise I can do.
That's right. You can only get so close
right.
to the surface in this kind of way. And if I make these pair of measurements I'm doing closer and closer to the same measurement, then the amount of noise goes down. So, you know, another way you could think about this is that suppose you're doing, you know, a large number of experiments and you think that your Stern-Gerlach apparatus is always oriented at the same angle, but actually it's fluctuating a bit. So sometimes you're measuring this, and sometimes you're measuring that, and you're calculating statistics. Well, at the end of the day, it's going to be an average of those guys, and so what you're going to really associate that measurement with is a POVM that isn't perfectly measuring the direction you think you're measuring. Yes?
I have a question that's not complicated.
That has nothing to do with that. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so the case that you have described is you made one or two measurements, but you don't know which one it is. But it can be equally also be described as measurements that for a small percentage of the time that you just let the thing that you're measuring pass
mm-hmm.
without the state being undisturbed. So I guess, so is it true that sometimes that you let the state pass without it being administered. So it's like describing two different things.
Well, so far I've said nothing about the rule that would tell you how to make predictions about the outcomes of subsequent measurements. So the sorts of measurements I'm imagining here, you know, schematically, they only have an input aperture and no output aperture. Of course, we could imagine experiments where, you know, after I've probed the system, I pass it on, I pass it out of the box, and maybe later it's going to be measured again. And the operationalist needs to tell a story about what's the most general kind of transformation that can occur to a density operator when you do a measurement on it. And tomorrow, I won't explain what that most general thing is. I'll sort of tell you what it is. We're not going to go into it in detail. But, you know, in the text, you know, undergraduate textbook formulation, the projection postulate, where you take the state psi and you project it down into the subspace that you've just, that is associated with the outcome you got. So let's say you're measuring Z spin and you get the up outcome. You project whatever the original state was, the final state is now Z spin up, eigenstate. So that's a rule for how the state ought to transform. But it's not the most general form of transformation that can occur. What I'm saying here is nothing about the transformations. I'm just saying, what's the most general inference you can make about the system, the most general set kinds of statistics you can get coming out of a measurement. I'm not following you.
Okay, never mind. I can ask you after class.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. So, other questions about this stuff? Yes?
Okay. We could choose a different different set of PLM for this case.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of doing 1.5, 0, 0, plus 1.5, plus, doing 1.5, 0, 0, plus 1.5, minus, minus,
right? Yeah, you could coarse grain. You know, you could say the first outcome of this guy is the mine associated with the minus, and the second outcome is associated with the plus. And then you would be coarse graining this and this, and this and this, and you'd be measuring along this axis. Yeah. In fact, let me move to that. So this is a short aside on joint measurability of POVMs. So we know, if I ask you, when can you measure two Hermitian operators jointly? What's the answer?
If they commute.
If they commute, exactly. So the condition is commutation. So you could ask the same thing of two POVMs. You can say, when is it that I can measure two POVMs simultaneously? And it turns out that we still don't fully know the answer to that question. It's still an open problem. There's been some progress, but we don't have the full set of conditions yet for when some set of POVMs can be measured jointly. But let me tell you a bit about it, because now we have the enough structure to talk about this problem. And I think it's an interesting problem, because let me go back a few slides to motivate it. So in the beginning, I asked, let's see, where is it? Here we go. I asked, what kinds of procedures, measurement procedures, might not be represented by Hermitian operators? And so, you know, one of the answers that was given was, what if you have a mixture of projective measurements? And so we talked about the mixture case. But here's another interesting example. There should be tensor products in all these spots here. So if you take a system you're interested in, and you couple it to another system, a probe. So this is like a von Neumann model of measurement, where you're saying, I have a system, I'm coupling it to another system, and then I'm going to measure this system to find out information about that guy. So if I have A, some Hermitian operator on the first tensor, with P, the momentum operator for the probe, then that means that because the momentum operator is the generator of displacements, that probe is going to be displaced by an amount that corresponds to the eigenvalue of A. So I won't go into the details, but this sort of coupling between your system and your probe leads to the probe having some information about the observable A. And so it's a way of measuring A. And if you have a different kind of coupling, say between B and a second probe here, so there's a tensor product here and here, then I can measure B by coupling to that second probe. So if my Hamiltonian has this in it, I'm measuring A, and if my Hamiltonian has this in it, I'm measuring B. If my Hamiltonian describing the coupling between the system and the probe looks like this or this. But I could also write down a Hamiltonian that couples with both of those terms. And it feels like this should be a simultaneous measurement of A and B, because you know one probe is going to be finding out about A, the other probe is going to be finding out about B. And yet we know that operators that don't commute can't be measured simultaneously. So you know, what happens? How can I possibly model the effective measurement here? And the answer is that what happens when you do this sort of thing is that you're measuring a POVM. Okay, so you're actually measuring A and B simultaneously, but each of those measurements has a certain amount of noise in it. So they're not perfect measurements of those observables. Okay, so now I'm going to give you an example of that joint measurement. So I'll go back to where I was in the talk. Okay, here it is. So first, let me point out that there's an operation you can do called coarse graining. It's very simple. If you do a measurement here of this POVM, FJ, say it's got a whole bunch of different outcomes, and then I just coarse grain these outcomes. I say if the outcome of this guy was 1, 2, or 3, then the overall outcome of this whole procedure is just going to be 1. And if the outcome was in this set, then the overall outcome that I report is 2, and so on. So this is just a way of saying ignore some information about the outcome of this measurement and report only which set the outcome fell into. And if you ask, well, how do I model that in terms of the operators, it's very simple. It's just, you know, take the set SK, say, you know, this set here, sum all the operators associated with that set, and that's the operator that will tell you the probability of getting outcome 1. You know, the proof is, like all the other proofs, you just say, well, what is the probability of getting a given overall outcome, K? It's just the sum of the probabilities of getting the J's in the set associated with it. And then if I plug in the quantum expressions for these probabilities and I move that sum inside the trace, I just get the sum of the operators. Okay, so coarse graining is represented very simply in terms of these POVM elements. Okay, so we already saw an example of coarse graining. If I had chosen to do either this measurement, the 0-1 basis, or the plus-minus basis, with probability half each, and I kept track of which one I had done, then I would be measuring a 4 outcome POVM. So it would just have these 4 bits in it. So you know, either I'm measuring, you know, these two would tell me you are measuring this guy, and this is the first outcome, this is the second outcome. And these two correspond to measuring the other guy with two outcomes. And then if I want to forget which one I'm choosing to measure, then I just coarse grain over these two and these two. Right? Apologies. I decided somehow last night that it would be clearer if I did this in terms of spin states. That was a mistake. But here it is anyhow. These states, 0, 1, plus, minus, on the block sphere, if I think of them as spin states, they're up along the z-axis, down along z, up along x, down along x. So I've just changed notations. The coarse graining I'm imagining is this one. You take the coarse grain, this element and this element, into one operator. So you just sum them up. And you coarse grain this element and this element into one operator. So that's the one, the first example I showed. It's the coarse graining of these two and the coarse graining of these two. And it corresponds to a noisy measurement of spin along this new axis n, which is between z and x. Okay. But as the question a moment ago pointed out, we could have chosen to coarse grain differently. We could have combined this outcome with this one here, and this one with this one. And we would get a different pair of operators. And it turns out that, you know, geometrically that corresponds to this combination and this combination. And that's just a noisy measurement of spin along this axis. So I have a noisy measurement of spin along n, and this axis is just perpendicular to n. So any two perpendicular axes, you can do a joint measurement of spin along those two axes, but they're noisy. And this is exactly the amount of noise you have to have. This. So it turns out it's 1 over root 2, so about 0.7 times the projective measurement, plus about 0.3 times a totally random outcome. So it's the addendum to the stuff you'll read about in undergraduate textbooks is that although it's true you can't do a measurement of, say, spin along Z and spin along X simultaneously, you can do noisy versions of those measurements simultaneously just by doing a measurement that has these four outcomes and then coarse graining in one of two different ways. Good, and that explains that example I showed you earlier where you have a coupling to two different Hermitian operators that don't commute. In the end of the day, what you'll find is that you're implementing noisy versions of the A measurement and a noisy version to the B measurement simultaneously. Okay, the second way in which we know that we have to have more general kinds of representations of measurements, more general than projective, is the following examples. This is basically the last example for the day. I could take a system and feed it into a box which did the following. It took that system, it pairs it up with another system, which I'll call little a, prepared in some way, and then it does a joint measurement on the pair. And one way you could think about this joint measurement is maybe it couples the two systems together and then does measurements on each individual system. So effectively what this means is that, you know, rather than just looking at the system alone, I'm coupling it to something else and doing measurements on the pair. So if you ask how should I represent this whole box, it's a similar story. So we know that if I have rho s tensor tau a as my preparation, and I do some measurement on the pair, the probability for getting outcome k is just the trace over the whole Hilbert space of that projector times that tensor product. This trace can be split up into trace over S and trace times trace over A, and I can move the trace over A inside, and I can move it through the rho S, because rho S is acting on a different Hilbert space. So all I need to do is the trace over A of this operator here, the product of my projector with tau, the density operator for system A. This whole thing is an operator on S, because this was an operator on SA, and at the end of the day, I'm tracing over A. So this object now is an operator on the Hilbert space of the system. And if you look at it, you'll find it, you study its properties, you'll find it's positive. And if I sum over K, it sums to identity. So these operators form a POVM. Here is the, well, I won't go into the proofs of those, but here's just the statement of positivity. So for any vector in the Hilbert space of the system, these EKSs are positive. And if I sum over them, I get the identity operator on the Hilbert space for the system. So again, I have a positive operator valued measure. Here's an example. They're a bit less trivial than the case of mixtures of projections. But you know, here's one. If you prepare your second system in some coherent superposition of 0 and 1, and then what you measure at the end is what we call the Bell basis. So here are four entangled states which span the four-dimensional Hilbert space of these two-dimensional systems. So these are both qubits. So that's a perfectly valid measurement. I can then ask, well, what's the POVM associated with this whole box? And I won't go through the calculation in detail, but you just have to plug in the projections onto these four states here as your pi's. So that's just the outer product of these phi k's. And take the trace with tau, the density operator for this guy. But I've assumed that this is in a pure state, so that's just trace of pi with the projector onto theta, which just turns into an expectation value with respect to theta. And then each of these are partial inner products. So this thing is a vector on S. This is a vector on S. And when you work out what those vectors are, you find that they are these four points on a plane of the Bloch sphere, corresponding to plus theta from the z-axis, minus theta, pi plus theta, and pi minus theta. So at the end of the day, the four operators, positive operators that appear in this POVM are these four, which correspond to these four points here. And if I choose theta to be pi by 4, that's exactly the four I was describing earlier, which if you coarse grain in two different ways, give you, you know, noisy measurements of z and x. Okay, so that's trying to give you the a flavor for how POVMs arise from coupling to other systems. So the last thing I'll say is that it connects to Tiber's question earlier. If you ask, is it the case that every set of operators for which the elements are positive and some to identity, is it the case that that can be implemented by a mixture of projective measurements? The answer to that question is no. But if you ask, is it the case that you can always implement that by coupling to another system and then doing a measurement on the pair, the answer is yes. So there exists some, so the second system is typically called the ancilla system. There exists some state of the ancilla, that's why I've been calling it little a, by the way. There exists some state of the ancilla and a projective measurement on the pair such that the effective measurement on the system is described by the POVM you're interested in. And that result is known as Nymark's theorem, and I won't give you the proof of it, although you can find it in Nielsen and Chuang if you're interested. So it means that you can characterize all the measurements by POVMs. There's always a way of implementing every such measurement. And with that, I guess I'll conclude. Now what we know, I haven't said anything about the transformations, but we know that the most general preparations are associated with density operators, and the most general measurements are associated with POVMs. And this is going to put us in a good position for talking about axiomatization next time. So let's stop there.